Welcome to the Far and Beyond podcast, hosted by the Contracts and Fiscal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. This podcast is for the federal government attorney navigating the complex intersection of acquisitions and fiscal law and policy. I am your host, Major Ellie Sewell.
And I'm Major Jason Floyd.
Major Steve Soley.
And together we are your co-hosts. On this episode, Far and Beyond, we have Mr. Brantley with us to discuss intellectual property. Mr. Larry Brantley is an intellectual property counsel with U.S. Army Material Command, Redstone Arsenal. He works through the entire scope of IP issues, such as patents, trademarks, copyrights, trade secrets, and data rights affecting AMC and arising from its acquisition operations, R&D, additive manufacturing, and other activities. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Well, thanks for having me. So I'm intellectual property counsel for the Army Material Command. So I'm in Huntsville. We sit in the headquarters office in the Office of Command Counsel. I support directly the Command Counsel, Brian Tolan, and the Deputy Command Counsel, Bobby Davis. And the office supports General Mohan, who is the commanding general for the Army Material Command. And then from where I sit, we're responsible for all the MSCs as well, the major subordinate commands, AMCOM, TACOM, CECOM. And particularly with intellectual property, I'm one of 16 different intellectual property attorneys spread out through the commands.
For a four-star command, that doesn't sound like a lot of attorneys, sir. Are you pretty busy then?
Yes, very, very busy. You're correct. Yeah, I think the organization has maybe 90,000 employees, counting civilian and military. And I think if you throw in contractors, it's 120,000. So yeah, it's a lot to have 16 people dealing with IP issues.
So with those 16 people, what type of issues do you see on a typical day?
Okay, so that's a great question. So I interact with DOD, particularly DOW now, the IP cadre. I interact with headquarters, DA, OGC, Office of General Counsel, and in particular the Army IP cell. I interact with OTJAG to deal with litigation. I also interact with DOJ to deal with patent infringement litigation. But most of the time I spend is dealing with and supporting the major subordinate commands. There's some attorneys, Albert and Tyrion over at AMCOM, Greg Gibson at TACOM. And so we coordinate and deal with issues that come up. There's a variety of issues that we have to deal with. The two hot topics are right to repair. It's very clear from senior leaders that they want to be able to do that. So what we are doing as a team is trying to facilitate that and make that happen. Another issue that has gotten a lot of my attention, not so much with the press, is markings. When it comes to intellectual property and data rights in particular, markings are a big deal. The technical data, the computer software, they have to be marked in a particular way. Because of some recent decisions in the Federal Circuit and the ASBCA, the Armed Services Board of Contract Appeals, contractors now feel like and arguably can mark data in a particular way as long as those markings are directed to third parties. Why is that important to me and why is that a big deal for us? It's because there are lots of contractors and now they all want to create their own new marking, and that creates a really large administrative burden on us to deal with. So what we're trying to do is generate a standard one. Like if you look at the DFARS, there's really like four markings that are allowed under the DFARS scheme. So what we're trying to do is create what I call a non-government notice marking that's standardized. We see the same thing, short and sweet. I don't like long marking, so those are two of the issues that we're spending a lot of time dealing with.
So sir, that's a lot to unpack, and we'll get to some of that today. But before we do, can you just tell us a little bit about your background? You know, what did you study? Are you a patent attorney? Are you licensed?
Sure. Yeah, so short version of a long story. Been practicing law 28 years. I was an electrical engineer for around 5 years before that. Have an undergrad in electrical engineering from Auburn University. It's been a minute back in the day, 1989. And then worked as an engineer for a few years, worked on a master's at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, and then kind of got bored with that and moved off to law school in 94 and 97. And so after I graduated in 97, I've been practicing law 16 years in private practice, 12 years now with the government, doing, if it relates to IP, with the exception of bankruptcy, I haven't done a lot of bankruptcy stuff dealing with IP, but when it comes to intellectual property, getting patents, what we call patent prep and pros, helping people get patents, same thing with trademarks, helping people register copyrights. I've litigated cases across the United States, patent infringement, trademark infringement, copyright infringement, served as an expert on patent law in a couple litigations, primarily, and that's really private practice stuff. Now, with the government, I have a very heavy focus on data rights, trying to avoid disputes. I mean, when I was a young lawyer, litigation was great. It's where I wanted to be because it was, well, it was an interesting way to spend your time. But from the client's perspective, it takes a lot of time and money away from whatever their main purpose is, creating products or whatever. So I try to avoid it if I can. Sometimes you have to litigate, and if you have to dance, you have to dance. But I try to avoid that and guide the client to prevent it. And if we're in a situation where we're close, try to, you know, negotiate a resolution without it, because litigation is just, it's not where anyone really wants to be.
Sure. So you did mention data rights. Just for the audience, you're here with us today because the Jack School is putting on a course and you were gracious enough to teach us about data rights. Let's jump into that. What are data rights, if you can? Just give me a 5,000 foot view.
Sure. So data rights is just a fancy term for license right. Basically, when in DoD in particular, what we're talking about is technical data. Think drawings for the Apache, components of the Apache, the Blackhawk, the technical drawings that show how different parts in that system work, and then computer software. The Apache in particular has a lot of software, and at most systems, to be honest with you, have a lot of software. And so the data rights, the government pays to develop those weapon systems, for example. Those drawings get generated, the software gets coded, and the government, even though it's paying under the standard rules, typically the contractor that does that for us owns it, but the government gets certain rights, either unlimited rights, government purpose rights, or limited rights if we're not paying. And so data rights are the license rights that we get when we develop these systems.
Yeah, so you mentioned a couple of those rights. Can you just break it down, like what those regimes look like in terms of what applies to like commercial, what applies to non-commercial products and services?
Sure. So in the non-commercial, we'll do that first. Unlimited rights means what it sounds like. We can pretty much do anything we want. Don't really need it when I'm involved in data right disputes. I'm not really trying to get that because it's usually broader than what we really need. Generally, we're trying to use competition, by the way. Competition drives prices down by about 25%. It's kind of the rule of thumb. So trying to get at least government purpose rights, which are rights that allow us to use it, like it sounds, for the government. Limited rights comes up when it's not us paying to develop the weapon system or the component of the weapon system. That's the contractor's money. And so because they're paying, it's kind of follow the money. Because contractors are paying, we get limited rights, which limits our ability, for example, to manufacture without their permission. If we have GPR and limited rights, we can manufacture the part ourselves, which, by the way, is, I don't think I mentioned it, but additive manufacturing also is a big hot topic right now. And it does tie into right to repair.
Sir, before you go on, just I have no idea what additive manufacturing is. Can you give me a quick snippet on that too?
Sorry, sometimes I just jump around. Okay, so AM is, and really it's like 8-10 years old, maybe even older than that, but think of the little 3D printer that some, really your teenage kid may have at home, and they're printing out cool widgets that they like. Well, anyway, soldiers have been using that since at least 17 that I'm tracking, where a soldier, I think it was in South Korea, printed out a lens cap they needed because the things kept getting lost, and it made the equipment where the sensor was located non-mission capable, and he was tired of waiting, I think, 6 weeks to get the replacement because it was, you know, it took a while. So AM is really this idea of, instead of what we'll call conventional or subtractive manufacturing, where you take a block of metal and you carve it into whatever, or you create the different pieces, additive, you just print layers of a material, usually a polymer for the cheap stuff, but we do titanium, and you can print, you can use a computer. It's like you're really like your printer at home that prints on a piece of paper, only it prints material, a polymer, and it can print these different shapes we need. We use it to make, for example, very simple knobs on radios, door handles for Humvees, you know, really simple devices you see all around that are easy to make. And you can do more complicated stuff as well, but that's really what it is.
Okay, thanks for that. All right, sir, so you talked about sort of two buckets or categories of rights. We've got the unlimited, we've got GPR. What are the other more limited categories?
Okay, so there's two. There's limited rights and there's restricted rights. And limited rights has to do with tech data, think drawings. Restricted rights has to do with computer software. And the rights, just to give you an example, when we say restricted rights, what are you talking about? Well, If anyone's ever bothered to look at the software license you have for your Microsoft Office or any of the software running on your personal computer, if you read it early on in the front, it says you can make one copy for backup purposes, you can save that, but otherwise you don't have the right to do very much with it. Same thing in the government. It's a little bit different because we have greater rights even in the restricted right regime, but it's similar to the commercial thing, just expanded a little bit. But and both of those, by the way, are tied to the fact that we didn't pay for that. The contractor paid for it. And that's why, not surprisingly, our rights are more limited in both of those contexts.
So we have these categories. Are those defined anywhere?
Yeah, good question. Yep, the DFARS, which Defense Federal Acquisition Regulation Supplement, it's a supplement to the FAR, the Federal Acquisition Regulation. It's the main clauses, there's a couple parts, but, and actually I'll just, the part is 227.71 for tech data and 227.72 for computer software and computer software documentation. They're lumped together. And within the DFARS, you'll find all the contract clauses that spell out everything we were just talking about. Who gets unlimited rights and when, who gets limited rights and when. They're all in the clauses in the DFARS that show up in contracts that we sign with our contractors and lay all that out on who gets what.
So is that it though, sir? Are we just sort of stuck with those kinds of categories, or are there a way for us to negotiate?
That's a good question. Actually, there is now, probably in the last 5 years, I think it is, maybe 10. No, I think it's five. There's a statutory preference for what we call specifically negotiated license rights. And basically, if those standard or default rights that we were just talking about, unlimited, GPR, limited, restricted, don't meet our needs, or don't meet industry needs, for example, then we can negotiate and create a specifically negotiated license that is some variation on the limited rights or the GPR or the restricted rights. There's a floor. When we do that negotiation, we can't go below limited or restricted, but we can tailor it to really satisfy any concerns industry may have with the way some of that data is used. And keep in mind, they own the data, even in some cases, if we paid for it, we just have license rights. So we can, and that varies. It's really wide open on how those can be drafted other than not going below the two floors that I mentioned.
Just to follow up to that, sir, who determines what rights we need within the Army? Like, is it going to be a judge advocate in the field? Is there some sort of IP specialist at a brigade or a division? Or,
you know, that's a good question. That's really a program office or requiring activity. The attorney, like myself, we counsel, we advise, we try, we provide the legal guidance to execute on whatever it is they're trying to accomplish. But it's the requiring activity. It's the commander who needs to do something, and they reach out and ask the PEOs, or I guess PAEs now. The reorg is going on as we speak. They reach out to those requiring activities and they tell them, I need this in the field. Then they go say, okay, we'll issue contracts and create that new widget or whatever it is that they need. And then as attorneys, we just help make sure those contracts that get put in place, make sure they get. Really, it's not so much the commander's concern at that point. It's more of a long-term sustainment concern from where we sit at AMC, because we deal with sustainment. And the back-end cost is where most of our money's spent. If you can look around, the term that's floated around, or the number that's floated around the most, is 70% of the cost of a system is on the back end. And if we're in a vendor lock situation, for example, where we have to go to a single contractor, the price can be higher than it could be if, for example, we have competition, which generally will drop that 25%. So we get involved once the requiring activity says, I need this widget. We get involved legally to make sure that on the back end, when we have to sustain that equipment for, in some cases, 50 years or longer, we have appropriate rights so we can keep costs where it should be.
So if we have the right package of rights, we're on that sustainment leg. What are some of the issues that you're facing in terms of keeping that sustainment together with that data? Is it packaged right? Like, what are some of those issues that you see?
Well, I guess the biggest one now would be this idea of right to repair. I mean, sometimes you make program decisions not to repair, for example, in the field. For example, we're not going to repair a Black Hawk engine out in the field.
Sir, I can do a lot. Give me a, fair enough. A Gerber.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, if you have the right AM equipment and stuff and you can take apart a Blackhawk engine in the field, then so be it. Then we'll execute on that.
I'm learning a lot about Jason today.
I'm just kidding. I cannot do that at all.
But generally speaking, the right to repair issues is a big deal. In some cases, it's more of a you mentioned the fact we've got the data, that we've got the package. Sometimes we may not have the data we need, in part because maybe no one thought about it. Maybe some part of the system broke in a way no one anticipated, so we didn't have a spare part. So then we can look at reverse engineering, trying to create that part ourselves, or trying to get the contractor to give us the data that we need to try to make the part and execute the repair in the field. So it depends. That's really the main thing.
So with the whole right to repair, especially if there's a lot of focus on it, is it better then to the beginning when you're negotiating these contracts to overbuy the data rights and get those licenses versus underbuying, maybe not doing enough?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The short answer is no. We don't want to overbuy, and throwing money at it doesn't necessarily solve the problem. And it is a heavy lift. It can be difficult to anticipate what you're going to need in a system 50 years down the road or 20 years down the road or 5 years down the road. But that is the task to some extent. And contractors do it now, and program offices do it now. Every time, like I think it was the Patriot, there are all kinds of different spare parts. They know these parts are going to wear out, and so they anticipate that. They pre-order spare parts. And they can do that in the AM context too as well. One of the big Army IP policy issues that came back in 18 was to specifically not do what you were just talking about. That is to overbuy, because it's a balancing act. On one hand, we want to incentivize industry to come up with the newest, latest, and greatest widget that we need to execute the mission. On the other, we don't want to take too much from them because sometimes they're doing that on their dime. So it's a balancing act. So the idea and the high-level guidance and the policy everyone's following is to get what we need. And that gets back to my initial point. What do we need? And sometimes that's hard to figure out. So the short answer is no, don't overbuy. Just try to figure out what a particular program's going to need, what parts are going to wear out. Pre-order those. Pay to have the contractors develop AM packages. AM is very specific. They're STP files and these other things that go to the printers that cause them to print the way we need to create the part. We can pay to develop that all up front. We can pay the contractor to do that in anticipation that we're going to want to do that in the field. And we can absolutely do that.
All right. So let's frame this more from like the 5,000 foot view to kind of what you might see in the field from like a judge advocate perspective at a brigade. So say we are at one of these transformation initiative type of units, and we want to buy like this small tracked item. Say it's like EOD unit, and this is commercial off-the-shelf thing. What kind of data rights do you think we would need if we want to sustain that commercial off-the-shelf item, but also potentially add things to it of our own?
Okay, so two-part question. The first part, on how do you just maintain a commercial item you bought? So if you have a contract and you're buying a commercial item, then the DFARS clause that I mentioned in one of my presentations, 252.227-7015, has to do with the rights we get in commercial technical data, which is what would apply here, at least to the tech data, not any software that may be on it, and everything is software. But as far as the tech data is concerned, you want to make sure that clause is in there. Then also, it probably would make sense for someone to upfront figure out, okay, what's going to wear out on this thing that we may need to repair? I mean, you can solve it in some cases getting spare parts up front. But with the AM focus and the right to repair focus, there may be certain parts that we might want to repair in the field. And we can contract to get the technical data that would allow us to do that, like maybe AM, I don't know, some lever or panel or something. Some of the stuff I've dealt with before, we've had battle damage and it's panels and things that get shot, and we can just reprint one. But back to your question, we can do all that contracting wise up front. Now, when the second part of your question about modifications, I mean, as a general rule, you can go buy an item and then we can take it apart and do whatever we want with it. And so with this thing, without contracting for it, we're not getting any rights. Some smart soldiers are really smart, and they can take these things apart and figure out.
With a Gerber, maybe, sir.
Maybe. And they can figure out how to fix something. Or, and I don't know if I mentioned the example here, but you know, the years ago, there was this issue with this lens that needed to be put on, I think it was a FLIR or something. It was a very expensive camera, like $50,000 or something like that. And it was on a Humvee or some other wheeled vehicle, and the lens covers would get lost. And some soldier got tired of waiting months to get the repair thing, and he figured out he could just scan an existing one they had and then print it. And it was important because without the lens cover, when the vehicle moved, dust would scratch the lens, and then you trash a $50,000 sensor.
Ouch.
You don't want to do that. So my point is, there are a variety of things that have nothing to do with contracting or getting data rights, where someone just takes something apart, figures out how to fix it, and can fix it, not using anybody else's stuff, just using our stuff. Like in this case, you just scan it. He just scanned an existing part. That won't help you if there's a patent issue, but generally patents are not a major concern. There's a statute, 28 U.S.C. 1498, that basically says that if the government infringes a patent or copyright, side note, we really can infringe. It's more of use it without a license. A recent district court judge made that clear. Anyway, the point is that if there's a patent or something like that, and let's say we didn't know about it, for example, but it comes to light that somehow we made a patented part, well, then the contractor can go sue us in the court of federal claims and get reasonable compensation for that use. Now, how it will really work in practice, this is one of the things I didn't mention that I do. The Army regs are set up so that they don't have to go to court to sue us. They can file what's known as an administrative patent claim, which will come to me and then go up to headquarters DA. We'll evaluate that claim to see if there's in fact infringement or not. And if so, we'll pay the reasonable compensation, or if not, we'll deny it. So the point is, patents aren't really a big concern when it comes to scanning some part and making it. Now, if it's marked, patented, or there's a patent number on it, I mean, from a policy standpoint, I'm not really comfortable intentionally infringing on something when we know it's patented. So the better course of action in that context is to reach out to the patent owner and see if we can get a license. Or also, the patents can expire. And a lot of the stuff we want to make is really simple, and probably any covered patent coverage is probably gone, in which case any money in public can make it. Patents are limited monopolies. So.
Hey, sir, we were talking a lot about non-commercial and a bit about other technical data stuff. There's a push for commercial. As we all know, Sec Army, Sec War are really harping on it. Any thoughts or issues with respect to commercial when it comes to computer software or computer software documentation?
Yes. So commercial computer software and computer software documentation is not really governed by the DFARS. It's governed by the typical commercial licenses that would be out there. So typically when we buy commercial, we buy it subject to that license with two exceptions. One, if it doesn't meet our needs, then we can modify that license so that it does. And two, if it violates federal procurement law, then we can't agree to those clauses either. So in the commercial context, those are important issues to keep in mind. And by the way, commercial, a word on that, the reason the rights are different is because we're not paying. It's commercial. Somebody else is paying for it. So again, follow the money is a really common theme you'll hear. Whoever's paying generally has greater rights.
And just to be clear, right, that's sort of the thing I ignore when I open up a new software program for the first time, that click wrap sort of stuff, right?
That's right. Everyone's got computer software licenses at home. Whenever you open up your Outlook or your Word, there's a license that most people probably never ever click on. Yeah, that's the license I'm talking about, and they're tweaked and modified for, you know, government purposes when they need to be.
Good to know. All right, so just to recap, sir. So we talked a lot about data rights today. Super helpful. If I have it right, let me know. If I have it wrong, please correct me. But it's important to have and to understand what rights you have, right? Whether those are in the categories of unlimited, GPR, or restricted or limited, which are all different. You may have a specially negotiated license. And then even if you have the rights, you'd have to make sure you have the data, which is a separate deliverable. Did I miss anything there?
Nope, that's correct. Yeah, there's two parts, the rights and then actually having your hands on the tech data, or at least access to it, because you can't really enjoy those rights or execute unless you have the data to execute the repair or do the maintenance or whatever. If you can't see the tech data, it doesn't matter what your rights are. So you have to have both. That's correct.
And I'm going to be able to find out which rights I have and which data should be delivered if I have my hands on the contract, right?
Exactly. Yes, it's definitely in the contract. And one point I haven't hit on, the reason we're so focused is the government, just like industry, we want the benefit of the bargain. We want our return on investment because we're spending taxpayer dollars. Everyone sitting in this room, we all pay taxes. It's our money that's going to these contractors. And just like private industry, we want to make sure we get a return on our investment.
Mr. Brantley, thank you so much for coming and imparting your knowledge on us. I know I've learned some things today. So again, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to come talk to us.
Yes, well, sir. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us today in this episode of Far and Beyond. Please make sure to follow us and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. We love to hear from our listeners. Please continue to reach out to us on Facebook and LinkedIn. The information can be found in the show notes from today's episode. The views expressed today are those of the presenters, not that of the Judge Advocate General Corps, the Department of the Army, the Department of the Air Force, or the Department of War.